How was your TIFF experience compared to all the other ones?
I saw fewer films this year than I did in a couple of previous years, but it was all right. I think I made some solid picks. I got everything that I thought I had time for, so that was pretty good. I didn't feel like I was like picking up B-list ones or something from my short list or whatever. But yeah, it was cool to be back in like the full-fledged festival. Like place was busy. Like every screening was packed. There was a rush line for everything for the people who didn't get tickets in advance. And yeah, it was just a good atmosphere. Actually, the last screening I went to, which we'll talk about a little bit later, Banshees of Inisherin, it had one of the most like lively, entertained audiences that I've been in a while. Like
that's always fun.
We have all these traditions at TIFF. Like people will clap along to the big corporate sponsor if there's some sort of beat in it. So like this year's major sponsor was the jewelry brand Bulgari, and it was like Zendaya and Anne Hathaway just sort of vamping it up in this Paolo Sorrentino directed commercial, and there's this kind of beat that goes in the background. And so everyone had seen the commercial so many times by the end of TIFF, everyone was just sort of clapping along, like kind of sarcastically making fun of it.
I don't remember that when I went.
Yeah, it was, it sort of depends on the year. Like if there's a commercial that people are really annoyed by, they'll just start making fun of it in that way. There's also a bit before every screening where they thank the volunteers who come out to help people into their screenings. And this year,
they do that here too.
This year, there was a couple of guys up in the screening who were just like saluting the movie screen while this, while this commercial played. It was kind of fun. So you know, people were having a good time, which meant I had a good time. But yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later in the show because there's a lot to talk about. I saw a few good ones.
Okay, shall we get started?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to the 112th episode of the Extra Buttery Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Chen, in Vancouver. I'm joined by my co-host, Robert Snow, in Toronto. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good. So we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. I think before we get into Rob's stuff, I think we should get into the two TV shows that are on everyone's minds right now.
Yeah, it's a good time to be a fantasy fan, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's always a good time to be a fantasy fan. I think it's more a matter of personal preference, whether you like it or not. But certainly as a sort of cultural touchstone, we've never had TV shows this expensive, as you may have probably heard many, many times about how much money Amazon sunk into their Rings of Power show.
Evil does not sleep.
Beyond the darkness, tempting shadow, to bury us all beneath the mountain.
He has not one name, but many.
Yeah, it was something to the tune of like a couple $100 million just for the rights alone. Mm-hmm. And then the production budget to actually make it. Mm-hmm. I think they're confirmed for at least two seasons. And numbers have ranged from like $400 to $500 million. So yeah, they sunk a lot into this. This was a big swing for them. I think they saw that HBO was obviously making a multi-show franchise out of the Game of Thrones stuff with this House of the Dragon show, which you'll be talking about. So it's these two streamers going head-to-head, both kind of trying to corner either the same chunk of the fantasy audience or maybe two slightly different chunks, depending on how you kind of divide it up.
So that's really interesting you point that out, because I think the only thing they really share with each other is the fact that, one, yes, they're sci-fi, fantasy, you know, action, adventure, epic kind of stories. And the other is they're being released at around the same time. But otherwise, other than that, like character-wise, plot-wise, I don't see a whole lot of similarities.
True.
I think they kind of occupy a similar space, but it's kind of like a Venn diagram where the similarities between the two aren't as big as you think.
Yeah, in as much as that, like they're set in pseudo medieval worlds, and there are fantastical creatures and people in big gowns and tunics, and their swords and bows and arrows and stuff like that. They both have dragons too.
Yeah, yeah. So to the tune of roughly about $500 million a season, $1 billion overall for The Rings of Power. Do you want to set it up for us? Because from what I understand, this is not anything that's based in the books.
No, well, I mean, you have to define what you mean by books, because
it's not based on a book as like Hobbit or the three Lord of the Rings movies were.
True, true. And there was a lot of people going in thinking that, Peter Jackson and Warner Brothers already adapted Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So people assumed that the next logical one to adapt would be The Silmarillion. Unfortunately, that book covers thousands of years of mythology in Tolkien's world, and it's not quite as cut and dry the way Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit are. There's not the same kind of like easy climax and resolution. You know, it's a lot of mini climaxes and mini resolutions over a period of a long space of time. And Amazon didn't get the rights. The rights that they did buy for that crazy figure were actually for the appendices contained in The Return of the King. So this is like, picture a glossary or a dictionary that was laying out the timeline for a lot of things that came before the events of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, but also not The Silmarillion.
How familiar were you with the appendices, like the info in the appendices?
I was pretty familiar. I mean, it had been a while since I'd read them, like at least 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. but it didn't take me long upon starting the first couple of episodes to kind of fit myself into the timeline and be like, okay, I know where we are. There's still a lot that they have in front of them in terms of material. They have a big challenge ahead of them because there's a lot of stuff to compress. I don't think that they could very easily have something resembling a TV show without throwing a lot of material out and putting a lot of new material in. So we do see a lot of characters that didn't exist at all in any of Tolkien's writings being invented here for the purposes of like filling certain roles within a classic narrative. So you have to have your brave hero. So this time out, it's Galadriel, played by Morfydd Clark. You have to have your aristocracy or your lords and ladies who are kind of standing in the way of potentially fighting back against the evil that's growing. So you've got Gil-galad from the elves. He's the elf king who doesn't really want war anymore. He's ignoring Galadriel. She says that Sauron is still out there. And then you've got a group of men living on an island way out in the ocean. And they're also not interested in getting involved in war.
Well, kind of changed in the last episode, but yes,
a little bit. We'll see. What that was kind of a last minute revelation, so we'll see how far that goes. But did you have any, like, based on what you've seen in the first four episodes, it's the first half of this first season, do you have any like unanswered questions right now about where it's going?
Yes, a lot. Okay. so it's actually good that like I have someone to lean on who's more familiar with the source material. I just didn't want to say though, like, it did require a lot of setup in the first few episodes.
Oh yeah, it's very dense.
Like there is a lot of exposition, and that's not unlike the movies. Like the movie starts with this huge prologue, and if you watch the extended version, there's even more exposition about like the whole thing. Like Bilbo's birthday actually runs for, I think, for like 20 minutes.
Oh, it's big. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like literally nothing happens other than Gandalf smokes some weed and whatnot. Yeah, yeah. But one thing the show didn't make clear to me is what was the difference between Morgoth and Mordor and Sauron? Like, what is the relationship there?
Yeah, that's an important one. Yeah. So when the show begins, we're taken way back in the timeline, all the way to a period in the mythology that we haven't really seen on screen before, and certainly not in, like, The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings. A lot of people probably don't know that there's actually a whole pantheon of gods and goddesses in Tolkien's world that had kind of pulled back from Middle Earth, any kind of involvement in Middle Earth by the time The Lord of the Rings happens. So they had all this in the this whole pantheon. They had like a Zeus type guy. They had a Hades. They had, you know, it broadly kind of like aligned with Greek and Roman gods, or even Norse gods. I think Tolkien kind of preferred the Norse gods. So Morgoth was the Hades figure. He was the guy who, you know, one of the pantheon of gods. He rebels against all the good ones. He's the one evil guy, and he starts a war. And as in starting that war, he captures a few very precious jewels from the elves, and he takes them to Middle Earth. And they swear, the family of elves who owned those jewels, they swear a blood oath to go off and take down Morgoth at all costs. And over the course of that period of time, they get so committed to that blood oath, they actually kill other elves to achieve their ends. And they kick off this war that goes on for thousands of years. And finally, after all of that time, after like literally millions of people have died and all sorts of other little mini stories have played out, they convince the good gods to go and take down Morgoth and basically banish him into the void. And in so doing, Sauron also gets kicked out for a while, but he's not fully defeated. So
who's Sauron at this point? Is he like a general or something like that?
Like a lieutenant. Yeah. Like he, okay. He's less powerful than Morgoth, but he's still like a demigod essentially.
Okay.
He has the same power level as Gandalf and the wizards actually. Okay. And even a Balrog. Okay. They're all in the same tier.
Okay.
And so he kind of goes off and kind of hides himself away for a few thousand years, but Galadriel doesn't forget. And that's where we pick up with her story in the first episode, where she's convinced that Sauron's going to come back after that last cataclysmic war. And she's trying to tell anyone who will listen that he's going to come back and they've got to be ready.
Right. So the character of Galadriel is very interesting to me. I actually think it's kind of funny that 90% of Morfydd Clark's performance is kind of shouting under her breath. And that's just kind of the way Galadriel speaks.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she doesn't raise her voice because she's an elf, but you could tell that she wants to, like, just tear whoever she's talking to, like, apart. Because for whatever reason, they won't listen to her. So in the Lord of the Rings movies, we get the sense that Galadriel has like a bit of darkness in her.
Mm-hmm.
She has these dark visions that she obviously keeps to herself, but it's obviously eating at her in some form.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to see Galadriel before that happens. I imagine throughout the course of this journey, this is how Galadriel gets maybe too close to Sauron and Mordor. And maybe that's how she becomes a little darker. Because when we meet Galadriel, she is already very, very vengeful. She is mean. She is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say she's, you know, a detriment to the elves or the people she leads, but she is so singularly focused and so convinced that she is right that she's willing to do anything to accomplish that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I like that characterization. I think she's going to be a really good driving force for the show until she gets lost out at sea and meets this dude
who is
Halbrand, because he, to me, from what I understand, he's a character that was made up by the showrunners, correct?
Yes. He's never existed in any Tolkien writings as far as I know.
Okay.
Not even like the random letters that he used to send.
Okay.
Tolkien had this habit of like writing a letter to a friend and dropping a little tidbit about something he'd been thinking about, some bit of the lore, and it would only exist in the letter.
This is my biggest fear with the Rings of Power, is that somehow they introduce new characters that dumb down the show because they're supposed to be a proxy for like the human audience or some sort of moral, I don't know, compass or something like that. And the first impression you get from Halbrand is that he's this really attractive male who seems lost, is probably destined for something. And if you believe internet rumors, he's destined for something else.
Yes.
But he kind of feels like one of those like love interests that's just kind of shoehorned.
Yeah.
I'm praying that he isn't that character. So far, he hasn't done much to deny that he isn't that character. And that's one of the gripes I have about this show is that there's a clear good versus evil dynamic in this, very much like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
But I wish there was more ambiguity. I wish there was a little more gray area, like how Galadriel kind of embodies that gray area.
And to address those rumors about Halbrand, I think he and a few other characters actually will be some of the best opportunities for that morally gray stuff in the show, because you won't really see it from Galadriel necessarily. You'll see her get like sort of tempted by darkness, but she's the hero of the show and we know where she ends up anyway. But as for someone like Halbrand, because he's brand new, he's been invented by the writers, it's kind of open season on him. And there's been a lot of people saying, oh, well, maybe he's actually Sauron in disguise. Sauron, you know, in the mythology, Sauron comes to Numenor and he corrupts the people, and he's responsible for Numenor destroying itself.
So, just to interrupt, isn't that why Isildur is in the picture? Because as I remember, he was one of the kings who was corrupted by the ring.
Yes.
And I had always thought that he was the Witch King.
No, no. So,
but he is one of those riders, right?
No, he's not.
He's not?
No. So Isildur, who we meet as a young man starting in episode 3, he is the son of Elendil.
Yes.
So you see Elendil very briefly in the Fellowship of the Ring movie, in the flashback to the battle in Mordor. And he's the king of Gondor who is thrown against the rock by Sauron. He dies. Isildur picks up the shattered sword and then cuts the ring off of Sauron's hand. So Isildur goes on to take over the throne of Gondor from his father, and he takes the One Ring for himself and keeps it for a little while, but he's actually killed by orcs.
He's ambushed.
He's ambushed by orcs. A couple of years after the events of the beginning of that flashback, they zip forward a couple of years, and he's ambushed, he's shot by arrows, he loses the ring in the river, and then the ring stays in the river for thousands of years until Gollum finds it. So he never becomes a Ringwraith. So there's all of this stuff that's going to happen probably next season or even a subsequent season, like maybe season 3, who knows, where we'll see Numenor turn to evil and like Sauron will come in, he'll take the form of somebody, he will appear in Numenor, he'll convince them that they don't need the elves, that they don't need the gods and goddesses anymore, and he will tell them, hey, you guys can get eternal life like the elves if you just go and attack the gods and goddesses. So they get in their ships and they try to sail to the Undying Lands. The gods and goddesses don't like that. They destroy Numenor as a result. And Isildur, his father, and a small group of men, they sail to Middle-earth to found Gondor at that point.
Mm, okay.
So that's how that all takes place.
That's pretty cool. So in the Lord of the Rings, Frodo gets this vial of water called the Light of Elendil. Is it not?
Yes.
Is that related to this dude?
Not directly. Okay. Elendil Elendil the man is named after a star that.
Oh, I see.
And that that vial of liquid is more from the star, not the
not
man.
Numenor. Oh, I see. Okay, so that was kind of the confusion. But I mean, thanks for clearing all that up. But
yeah.
I have to say, like, the production value is fantastic. The orcs look fantastic.
Oh yeah.
A little bit too much slow-mo for my liking.
Yeah.
But I can see like totally the artistic endeavor behind it.
Yes. I mean, they're trying to you can see a lot of like common elements between the Jackson movies and this, but there's also subtle differences. So they're not, you know, we're not expected to believe that this is all the same universe as the Jackson films. I think that opens them up to kind of make little tweaks. Like the orcs here, they have white skin. They don't have black skin, you know, little things like that.
They're also a little more terrifying, I find. Probably because we get to see them more, like close up.
Yeah.
Like when we saw the Uruk-hai, sometimes they were kind of like meme worthy. They were kind of like, there's a bit of like a comedic effect with them.
Yeah.
Like, meat's back on the menu, boys.
Yeah.
You don't get that here. No, they just straight up kill you and, you know, claw your face off.
Exactly. Yeah. And the wargs look different. Like the warg that they have is like really gross looking by comparison to the one in the Jackson films.
I like the one in the Jackson films. These ones look a little too cartoonish.
Yeah.
With the bugged out eyes and everything.
But definitely spooky. I mean, you have to hand it to them.
Yeah, they're all spooky. There's a couple things that remind me more of The Hobbit than Lord of the Rings. I kind of mentioned this to you. Part of it is Elrond's visit to the dwarf caves. Some of that feels a little bit too hobbity for me, where it's just people drinking and partying.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't care for that as much. The little boy who finds the hilt of the sword, he annoys me a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're doing with him. I mean, you know, they're obviously seeding the ground a little bit with like people who may go on to be the ring wraiths.
Yes.
You know, that's a thing. So like we see the guy who's leading the orcs. He seems to be like a former elf, maybe. It's unclear who he is.
Adar,
yeah. We're not sure, like, will he be a ring wraith? He already has some ring wraith like armor.
You know who he reminds me of? Grima Wormtongue.
Oh, a little bit, yeah. It's got
he's kind of like a servant. I don't know if he's going to be anything bigger than that, but he does seem sort of like the secretary for Sauron, kind of like how Grima was.
He might end up like the mouth of Sauron or something, the guy from the Return of the King.
That'd be really cool. But I was always under the impression that all the human kings became ring wraiths.
Almost all of them, yeah. Like Gondor, obviously, they stayed whole, you know. But there were other human kingdoms, I guess the Kingdom of the Southlands being one of them, who, you know, their king was offered a ring by Sauron, and then they took it and became a ring wraith eventually. So,
and how do the Harfoots basically become the Hobbits? I was under the impression the Harfoots are a Hobbit family, not...
They're sort of a Hobbit... They're a Hobbit community. They're the ancestors of the Hobbits, so...
Okay.
I mean, as far as the mythology says, the stuff that Tolkien wrote, they're not supposed to be too involved in the events going on around them. They're essentially supposed to eventually migrate over the mountains and found the Shire. That's really all they're kind of destined to do.
Uh-huh.
This business with like hanging out with this wizard guy, I don't know about that. That could be brand new for this show, like a total invention, or that could hint at maybe a different character. I don't know.
So the wizard dude was a bit of a weak link. I don't know what exactly they're gonna do with them.
Yeah,
but he does seem like a dumbed down Gandalf who goes to the Shire to party.
Yeah, and I feel like that's why I think that he's not Gandalf,
I don't think he is.
Yeah, because from everything that was written down by Tolkien, Gandalf and Saruman and Radagast, they came to Middle Earth with a mission, and they kind of knew what they needed to do when they got there. And this guy...
And did they arrive by asteroid as well?
It was never specifically said how they got there, but like they were supposed to arrive and help men. That was kind of what they were. So this guy, he may also be a wizard, but he may not be the one of the three that we know.
Well, he's a pretty shitty wizard if he can, you know, get caught in the net by the Harfoots.
Yeah.
One last thing before we kind of move on, the mark, the little E mark.
Oh, you hated that. I know.
I hated that.
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
In the moment, I thought it was cool, but then when you wrote to me and said that you thought it was like Star Wars level writing,
yeah.
I can kind of agree with that. Like,
you know, like when Rey holds up the dagger,
yeah,
and it somehow fits the skyline or horizon perfectly.
Yeah,
that's the impression I get from this. I wish it was a little deep. I get what they're trying to do, but just seemed a little lazy to me. Where it's like, oh my god, it's not a word; it's actually a map. I'm like, dude, that you could probably find something similar anywhere. You know?
Yeah.
But it is cool to see them, like, because I have a pretty good idea of where everything is geographically. Mind you, the little 3D scan of the land before each episode, that doesn't help me at all. That actually disorients me. But once they have the little E and they're like, oh, that's the mountain that surrounds the tower, I'm like, okay, now I get it. But, I mean, I get that time is limited, and I'm actually kind of disappointed that only two seasons have been confirmed, because I think there's a lot of things they could go into.
Yeah.
That was just a part of the series where I thought maybe I think they just didn't want to dwell too much time on that thing.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Like, they are going to have to throw out a lot of time, and they're going to have to compress things and cram things and rearrange. And the Jackson films did that too, you know, like,
yeah,
the Jackson film make it seem like all the events could take place within a few weeks, but in Tolkien's writing,
it was years.
Yeah. So there will be Tolkien fans who will be pissed off with some of the choices they make, but that's inevitable. That's just kind of what you got to do to make an adaptation. But But House of the Dragon is very different by on many fronts.
When I heard the sound of thundering hooves, splintering shields and ringing swords, and I placed my hand upon the Iron Throne, and all the dragons roared as one.
So why have you not watched this? First of all, let's just begin with that.
Well, I think it's purely Amazon winning out because they released it at the same time. And I think they were very savvy in doing that. They knew that if they released Rings of Power at the same time as House of the Dragon, they were competing for eyeballs because there are people like me who, you know, we're busy people. You know, we can't watch everything that comes out every week. So,
well, obviously, also you're a bigger Lord of the Rings person than Game of Thrones.
True, yeah, and that's always been true. Like even when the original seasons of Game of Thrones came out, I always had an allegiance to it. I appreciate what Game of Thrones does because mm-hmm. it gives you things that you would not normally see in a like cleaned up fantasy world. You get the sex, you get the gore, you get the complicated politics and the financial stuff and all of the the scheming and the very human stuff that mm-hmm. people like from that material. I don't know, but it maybe because it had been a while since the Hobbit movies came out and I had mm-hmm. the recent seasons of Game of Thrones closer in my memory, I was like, I'm in the mood for uncomplicated Lord of the Rings and not...
Yeah, like I said, like very clear good versus evil stuff. It's easy to understand. It's easy to cheer for one person. You don't get betrayed at all.
Yeah.
Whether because you like a character or a certain storyline or because you think the show is good.
Yeah.
God forbid Hot D, you know, ends up having the same fate as Game of Thrones. I highly doubt that will happen because House of the Dragon is a complete story. Like, it's not incomplete like The Winds of Winter. God knows when George R. R. Martin's ever gonna finish the books, but I highly recommend House of the Dragon. It's not as raunchy as Game of Thrones. I think people are past that. I think the showrunners heard how gratuitous the nudity and the violence was.
Yeah.
Granted, there's still quite a bit of blood in House of the Dragon, but it was definitely more focused on the Targaryen family dynasty, the politics behind it, the fight for the throne, both on the battlefield and in the courts. Millie Alcock, who plays a young Rhaenys Targaryen, who is basically... So this story would take place, I think, 3 or 4 generations before Daenerys is born. So she does a fantastic job. Matt Smith, a Doctor Who alum, as you know.
Yes.
He's an incredible Daemon Targaryen. And Daemon is sort of like a I wouldn't say he's a villain, but he's definitely more of an anti-hero,
right?
In the sense that he kind of does what he thinks is right, although he does have his allegiances. And of course there's the usual Game of Thrones stuff with the sex, the violence, and you know, all this like lore about, you know, the winds that are, or the winter that is coming and all things like that. The dragons, by the way, are awesome.
Is Daemon Targaryen as a character kind of similar to Jaime Lannister in the sense that he's coded as a villain, but then he occasionally does noble things out of a sort of sense of sort of a screwed up sense of a moral compass or something?
Like self-righteousness?
Yeah, like because like part of him knows what the right thing to do is, and then there's like the kind of more selfish side that kind of wins out.
So the reason why Jaime and Cersei Lannister engage in incest is because the Targaryens have a tradition of doing so. And Daemon and Rhaenys, who essentially is his niece, end up being in a relationship, end up having kids.
Right.
And their kids end up fighting against the kids of Rhaenys' father, who has kids of his own.
Right.
And there's this big civil war called the Dance of Dragons that basically the show revolves around.
Right. Right.
I will say the CGI is lacking a bit sometimes. I think Lord of the Rings visually, I think, is cleaner.
Interesting. Okay.
There's less questionable CGI sometimes. In House of the Dragon, there's a couple times where something clearly looks green screen or something clearly looks fake. I do think House of the Dragon takes more risks in terms of the direction. Because there's a lot going on. They intersperse scenes between like a childbirth or like a knights that are jousting. And it's kind of nice to have that dynamic. It's not something that you ever see before. And the whole dragon lore stuff is really awesome because so far we've seen 3 dragons. And they're all different. It's not like the Lord of the Rings. See, I'm getting confused now. Game of Thrones. It's not like Daenerys' dragons who are all just like different colors. These ones look and sound different. And supposedly there's a lot more that are going to come.
I mean, that the dragons in Game of Thrones were always the thing I was most interested in because they, you know, they're sort of, I think somebody else online said it best when they kind of compared them to nuclear weapons. Like, you know,
that's what they essentially,
nobody else can match somebody who has dragons. And so the power kind of hinges on them and they just look cool. Like it's, everyone wants to see a mm-hmm. giant dragon rush in and torch a bunch of people.
Well, I mean, you kind of see the same dynamic in Lord of the Rings, though, with the rings, right?
I guess, yeah. I mean, their powers are a little bit more subtle, or maybe a lot more subtle.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to breathe fire on you, yes.
They occupy a similar role in the story, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so I highly recommend Game of Thrones. I know you haven't watched it, but you should. It's definitely better than season one or two because there's not a lot of setup that's required.
Right, right.
Because it's still pretty fresh, and it's close to some of the best seasons from Game of Thrones.
Huh.
It's not quite there yet because we haven't hit a fever pitch with some of the conflicts yet. So we'll see how it goes.
Do you think there's there are opportunities in House of the Dragon for the kind of Easter eggs that Rings of Power has been dropping?
Yes, there's a whole ton.
Okay. So like, you know, dedicated fans will recognize certain things and then be like, ooh, and then they can kind of explain to the person they're watching, like, that's the thing. Like,
yeah, exactly. So one of the big things is this little dagger that King Viserys carries around is the same dagger that Arya Stark and Jon Snow used to kill the Night King.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Yeah. So that's kind of like taking life on its own. And they're obviously the same families and ancestors of the characters that we know from Game of Thrones. So it's easy to kind of tie it in.
Right.
There is a weird appearance by a pug, a French bulldog, I think. No, it's a pug. Pops out of nowhere for whatever reason, and it kind of threw me off a little bit, but then again, I mean, it's better than Ed Sheeran, you know, cameo, so.
Yeah, that was one of the weirder things that Game of Thrones did.
Oh, but you should watch for Matt Smith, so far in that whole universe, probably a top five actor slash character.
Right. All right, now. I can get on board with that. I mean, as you know, I was a longtime Doctor Who watcher, so, and I liked his... I liked his run as the character, so yeah, that's a selling point. Well, should we change gears and talk about TIFF?
Yes, do it.
All right, so 2022 Toronto International Film Festival is now behind us. We're recording the day it wraps up, and the People's Choice winner has already been announced. It is Steven Spielberg's The Fabelmans.
Really?
So... yeah, you can look for that to have a huge Oscar push behind it, I would say, because the winner of the People's Choice Award at TIFF frequently goes on to be a top contender for Best Picture. Sometimes it even predicts Best Picture in some years. So
we should have a very interesting year this year.
Yeah. And I think I ended up seeing a few things that also might end up as possible Best Picture nominees. You've got... The Woman King, that was a TIFF premiere. It's definitely headed for Best Picture. It's one of those kind of crowd-pleasing historical action epics that has a lot of like lines that are very specifically written to kind of like do a big like yeah kind of reaction from the audience.
I heard someone describe this movie as Gladiator but with a woman.
A little bit. She doesn't get enslaved and then claws her way back to prominence the way Maximus does in Gladiator, but it's got a lot of shared DNA, so that's definitely going to be in the conversation. Empire of Light, the new Sam Mendes film.
So this wasn't good, eh? I really like Sam Mendes.
Well, I mean, some of the critics who saw it at the Venice Film Festival thought that it was very cloying and kind of over earnest, if that makes sense.
Please elaborate. I'm a little confused.
So Empire of Light takes place 1981 south coast of Britain.
Okay.
At this sort of decaying four-screen movie theater, and it's managed by Colin Firth, guy playing this kind of dude whose marriage is failing, and he's kind of carved out this fortress for himself in this movie theater, and he's got this kind of fraying crew of ushers and concession workers underneath him, and they're all managed by a character played by Olivia Colman, who is she's kind of a woman who, she's not married, she doesn't have kids, her background is a little bit hazy when we meet her, and she does her best to kind of keep this place going, but you know, two of the four screens at the movie theater are closed. They're in disrepair. They don't get a lot of customers anymore. There's like racist gangs hanging out on the beachfront.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we follow Olivia Colman's character for most of it. And we learn that like she has a history of mental illness, and she's having a hard time kind of finding things in life to enjoy. And the character played by Colin Firth expects sexual favors from her in the evenings when they're closing up the movie theater. So it's a, it, like her life is kind of sad and she's very vulnerable. And into this situation comes a new employee played by Michael Ward, who's a young black man. And he forms a friendship and then later sort of a romantic relationship with the Olivia Colman character. And together they sort of, you know, find a new reason to enjoy working at this place and to, you know, live in this town. And there's nothing really wrong with it. It's just very earnest. It like, it's one of these movies that's in love with the concept of going to the movies and believes that.
I thought you loved that stuff.
Well, I do. I mean, like, you know, in my weaker moments, I'm like, yeah, movies can fix everything, you know? But the more you think about it, the more you kind of see it as like, you know, depending on your mood, you might find it a little bit manipulative, a bit kind of sugar sweet, and not all that substantial.
It sounds like a one of those like British literary fictions that's been adapted into a movie.
A little bit. I don't know if it's based on a novel or if it's an original work, but yeah, I think it's partially based on Sam Mendes's boyhood growing up in that period of time in England.
So which character is he supposed to be?
Well, that's the thing. Interestingly enough, like there's been all sorts of directors who have made movies where they kind of semi-autobiographically, you know, capture their childhood. The Fablemans, which one we were talking about before, is an example of that.
Kenneth Branagh just did one too, eh? Didn't he?
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh. So like there's a lot of directors going around right now that are kind of doing this thing. Sam Mendes doesn't create a character for this movie to kind of be his proxy. Mm-hmm. So he's not really present in it. But yeah, I think it's the kind of movie that will make it pretty far in the Oscar race because it is so sweet and, you know, it's going to hit people in it's going to tug on the heartstrings for a lot of audience goers.
Right in the feels.
It's going to hit you in the feels, you know. it might annoy critics, but, you know, it's beautifully shot. I mean, Roger Deakins is a cinematographer.
Mendes and Deakins. You can't go wrong. Anything directed by Mendes, actually, just visually is so appealing. Is there a lot of stuff with windows?
Yes, loves windows. Lots of windows. Yep.
He loves windows. So, I mean, it's almost comical by that point, though.
You can go into this movie and kind of sort of know what to expect, and there's not going to be anything in it that really annoys you. It's just, you know, I think you have to be looking for a little bit of like earnest, uplifting kind of, you know, heartwarming content. You can't.
That is a little different because Mendes' stuff usually in most recent years and in my memory have always been kind of dark and depressing.
There is some dark and depressing stuff here, but he eventually brings us over it, you know, he lets us overcome it. But because the stuff with Olivia Colman, like she's very unwell and she needs to stay in a mental institution for a while over the course of the film. But the racism too is also a big thing because the Michael Ward character is always being accosted by skinheads, you know, that kind of stuff. So Empire of Light, you know, not the worst thing I saw at the festival, but I don't think it'll make it all the way to Best Picture.
Well, it is a 10 film category, right? So
yeah,
it's difficult to say. But if it's not the worst, what was the worst? Now I'm curious.
Good question. It kind of pains me to say it, but the worst one I saw was Butcher's Crossing.
Oh no. This was the Western, right?
This was the Western, and not only that, it was the Nick Cage Western. you know, this is a genre that I don't think Nick Cage has ever worked in before. And that's saying something for a guy who, with a career as long and varied as him. But yeah, he plays a veteran buffalo hunter in 1874 Montana in this film. And he meets up with this young guy who has left Harvard. He's like the son of a Presbyterian minister or something or other. And this young kid who has this big dopey grin on his face for the whole like first half hour of the movie. He wants to have an adventure in the Old West, and he doesn't know a thing about surviving in the wilderness, but he has enough money in his pocket to finance a buffalo hunt. And he wants to meet up with a buffalo hunter to take him into the wilderness and show him the ropes. And so Nick Cage has got an idea because he's his character, Miller, is longing for the chance to go into the mountains and take down a pristine herd of buffalo. Because at this point in the 19th century, buffalo were being hunted almost to extinction. There were very few left close to settlements. So if you wanted to kill a whole bunch of buffalo, you had to go way off into the wild. And so they do. They get together with a few other guys, and they, you know, get on their horses and go off into this mountain pass. And then they just systematically murder a whole bunch of buffalo. And
sounds like a riveting film, just watching people kill buffalo.
Yeah. And so the young guy, you know, he's being exposed to the Nick Cage character's craziness over the course of however long. And so this guy starts losing his mind. You know, they start, the director's experimenting with all kinds of bizarre sort of visions and dream sequences. And for all of that those attempts at inventiveness, it doesn't really do anything different with the Western genre. You still get a lot of the same basic things that you expect from something in this genre. So, and then it tries to be a bit of a message film. You know, it ends with a few historical photos of, like, you know, the toll of the buffalo hunt and how many tens of millions of buffalo were killed in a short span of time in the 19th century, and kind of says
this is not a like a biographical film about any one person.
No.
Okay. So I kind of hate when that happens though.
Yeah. It's based on a novel, but, or a historical novel. And at the end they have a few title cards that kind of, you know, pay homage to the efforts of the Blackfeet Indian tribe of the area for helping restore the buffalo back to, like, you know, basically rescue the species over the past 100 years. But yeah, in terms of like drama, it doesn't really do a lot for you. It's just kind of, the director doesn't really know what to do with Nick Cage. You know, if you have Nick Cage in your movie, you want to let him loose. And this movie is kind of editing around all of his best outbursts. I mean, you got to have that Cage rage. And right. We get hints of it, but then the editor cuts away, and I'm like, nah, give me that, you know, freak out. So
right, fair enough. It's like casting someone who's like very attractive but never showing their face.
A little bit, yeah, yeah.
Unless that actor wants to go for an Oscar by putting on prosthetics.
Yeah, you do get to see Nick Cage with a bald cap, like shaving his head with a straight razor, which is kind of cool. He has a scene where he goes a bit nuts and he's just like killing buffalo with a rifle and screaming at them for like trying to crush his head. And, you know, that's the closest he gets to a true freak out, but it's not worth it. I wouldn't sit through the movie just for that.
Oh, yeah. Really? Did at any point did you want to walk out?
No. It would take an awful lot to make me want to walk out of any movie, but
yeah, same. But there have been movies in the past that have come close to
walking out. It was one of those movies that felt longer than it really is because it just wasn't connecting.
Actually, come to think of it, I think there is a Matthew Almeric film that I think ended up walking out on.
Oh, yeah. That
it was a French film and he played some author. I can't remember. But anyway, VIFF is coming up. I'm sure there will be a few that'll test my patience for sure. But what else did you see?
I'll talk about two more, actually.
Okay.
So one was the film that actually won the Palme d'Or this year at Cannes, Triangle of Sadness.
This one's on one of my must-see lists. The trailer looks hilarious.
And I will caution you, I haven't seen the entire trailer, but I doubt it shows the true level of, like, humiliation that it subjects the rich characters to.
Really?
Yes. Be prepared for, I'll just say, bodily fluids.
Is this like, you know, Borat level cringe?
No, I actually think Borat was a little bit harder to sit through because you knew that they were like real social interactions.
Yeah, okay.
You know?
This is like a movie. This is a script.
Yeah, this is a script. So the setup is that we were introduced to two models, a male and female model, who are dating. And they are, well, the woman played by Charlby Dean, Yaya, she is invited to a cruise because of her social media influencer status. And she takes her boyfriend, another model, with her on this cruise, and they're surrounded by all sorts of quote unquote real wealthy people, you know, people who actually paid their way and have made their fortunes in various industries. And over the course of a few days, they're exposed to just the full gamut of all of these rich people's, you know, selfishness. You know, they don't get too caught up in the individual dramas. But then one night, the ship's captain, played by Woody Harrelson, he gets drunk and kind of abandons the boat in the middle of a storm and basically gets so shit-faced that he's just sort of screaming communist manifestos into the PA system. And in the midst of all this, he lets a group of pirates aboard the ship, you know, and they just blow the thing up. And then the rest of the film is just the survivors trying to have like a castaway style existence on a remote island and kind of carving out a new society where, funnily enough, they reinvent capitalism amongst the seven or eight of them.
So what does the triangle of sadness refer to?
That is dropped very early in this kind of little bit of like found footage, I guess you could call it, where we're seeing auditions for a runway show, a fashion runway show.
Uh-huh.
And one of the people conducting the audition says to the male model character, oh, can you relax your triangle of sadness, which is just like
the eyes and nose and forehead,
the eyes and nose, and just, yes, it's like a modeling thing. So
I think part of that shows up on the trailer, where they're like, oh, you're modeling for H&M, look happy. Oh, you're modeling for some other high-end brand, look really mean.
Yes, that's the opening sequence of the film. So
okay,
that's how we're introduced to the model characters and how they end up on the boat. It's a lot of fun early on. If you can sit through the gross out stuff, that's also good, but it is long. It's 2 hours, 20 minutes. So it's long, and it kind of feels long by the end of it because there's like maybe seven or eight possible endings and the movie just kind of keeps going and doesn't end.
So it's a Christopher Nolan
a little film, bit, basically. Yeah. And you kind of get into this headspace where you're like, all right, I get the point. You know, the director, Ruben Östlund, has been making fun of these rich people for so long. You're like, all right, I don't need to see another scene where they get further humiliated.
Yeah.
But that's kind of his thing. I mean, people will know him from movies like Force Majeure and The Square. He won the Palme d'Or previously for The Square. So this is actually the second time he's won the prize. It's really funny to me that he keeps making movies, making fun of rich people, but they keep giving him prizes at Cannes, which is a festival for rich people. So,
well, but that's the inherent, you know, sort of irony and comedy with these shows is that Hollywood also likes to poke fun at itself for being pretentious and rich and glitzy, yet they do all the same things they always do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's always kind of like, well, hey, we're okay making fun of ourselves, but God forbid you actually go after their money or, you know, prevent them from doing all sorts of crazy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, make of that what you will. I mean, I don't think anybody's expecting Ruben Östlund's movies to kind of fix capitalism, but maybe it's cathartic to kind of go into one of his movies and just see these characters just subjected to the most humiliating situations and then kind of feel a little bit better. You're like, well, at least I'm not like them.
That's kind of like how ironic the whole thing is. Like, in what other section or demographic of the general population of North America would fall for freaking goop stuff, you know?
So I'd recommend that. I mean, it wasn't my absolute favorite, that I saw at the festival, but if you get a chance to see it, check it out, especially if you've liked Force Majeure or The Square.
Mm-hmm.
But to close things out, I'll talk about the movie I just saw last night, my final film of the festival, and my favorite one of the festival, The Banshees of Inisherin, the new film from Martin McDonagh. And I was so glad to get tickets to this one because it was definitely my most anticipated one of TIFF, and he delivered. I mean, people who like In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, we've got another winner on our hands here. Like, it is that classic blend of humor, violence, melancholy that you would recognize from all those previous films. This one's set in 1920s Ireland, in this tiny island called Inisherin, off the coast of the main part of Ireland. And the setup is almost like stupidly simple. It's just about how a character played by Brendan Gleeson decides one day that he doesn't want to be friends with his best friend anymore, played by Colin Farrell. And Colin Farrell's character, Patrick, is baffled by this. He doesn't understand that these two guys have been friends their whole life, and he can't get his mind around the fact that Brendan Gleeson's character doesn't like him anymore. And ostensibly, the only reason that Brendan Gleeson has is just that he is kind of despairing of the fact that he's living out the rest of his years on this tiny island with no prospects, no wife, no family. And he finds Colin Farrell's character dull and not all that interesting to talk to. And he's just the boredom of, you know, sitting around the pub talking to this Colin Farrell character for the rest of his life is just so frightening to him that he decides he doesn't want to be friends with him anymore. And this little spark between them is enough to set off this whole series of grievances. And it's just one like comical like setup after the other, where slowly more and more of the town turns against Patrick and he gets more and more desperate to win back Brendan Gleeson's friendship. And eventually it literally gets to the point where Brendan Gleeson's character, who is a fiddler, he's a musician, he starts threatening to cut off a finger for every time Patrick speaks to him. And he's serious about it.
Why is Patrick so hated?
He's just dull. That's literally the only reason that's given.
No, but like the rest of the community hates him too.
They slowly start to like, it's not that they hate him. It's just that they don't understand why he won't let it lie. And they're like, you know.
Well, in this situation, Brendan Gleeson's the asshole.
A little bit. And it starts out that most of the town is kind of thinking like, what's wrong with you? Like, why would you consider cutting off your fingers just because this one guy's talking to you? But the more serious he gets, the more the town is kind of like, well, I mean, the simplest solution here is just for these two guys to not talk to each other anymore. But Patrick won't let it alone.
Well, they also, because they probably need a fiddler. And if he cuts off one of his fingers, he can't be a fiddler anymore.
Yeah, it gets harder and harder for him because he does end up, you know, not to spoil things, but, you know, some
you
digits
kinda just did spoil
some
it.
Digits start disappearing, let's just say.
I love Martin McDonagh when he does all these like batshit crazy stuff with crazy characters. Colin Farrell is so underrated in these roles.
He's
a fantastic character actor. Don't ever let him be a leading man again or the handsome leading man again. He needs to do this stuff for the rest of his career and he'll have a very, very good career.
I 100% agree.
Not that he already has.
Now, I will say that like the first two thirds of this movie are like a laugh a minute. Like there's something funny happening constantly, but as it gets into the final third, it gets a lot more melancholy and the stakes start to kind of catch up with the characters and you're like, oh, okay, it started funny, but now it's getting kind of serious. And so you kind of have to be prepared for that. But there's a few other great little moments sprinkled in that don't have anything to do with Colin Farrell or Brendan Gleeson. You've got Barry Keoghan in there playing another weirdo, which he's so good at. He's actually like, he's playing a character named Dominic, who's more of like the town idiot, basically, who is even less liked than Patrick. He's just sort of lolloping around, like, you know, just causing trouble. And then you've got like the owner of the town's general store who does, you know, she's such a gossip that she will steam open people's envelopes and read their mail before she gives it to them. Just little kind of like details about the way these tiny towns operate, you know, like rural country life. And parts of it actually felt kind of familiar to me growing up in Newfoundland, you know, the obviously it was like 60 years later, but
who was the dull friend that you've threatened to, you know, basically cut off from the rest of your life?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been mad enough at somebody to threaten to self-harm, to get them to shut up. But now that it's on the table.
Well, who's the one friend that you dumped because they were too dull?
I can think of a few.
Is it the guy who's like, oh my God, Pirates of the Caribbean was the best movie ever? I have heard that. You laugh. But I have heard
I believe
that.
It. Yeah, there's got to be somebody who's still earnestly watching those movies.
And this wasn't like not even the first Pirates of the Caribbean, which is actually good. This was like at World's End or one of the sequels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Jerry Bruckheimer kept making those things because somebody was watching them.
Until they stopped and it lost a whole bunch of money. Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say like, I mean, who knows? Maybe Banshees of Inisherin will end up in the Best Picture running. I don't think it would win. It's too...
It's not their cup of tea.
No, it's, I mean, people will recognize it for what it is, like how hilarious and well-crafted it is, but it's not enough of a crowd pleaser, enough of a mainstream type of thing to get Best Picture.
Well, it's kind of like in Bruges, right? Like, I think it only had one nomination for screenplay, and then other than that, it didn't get anything else.
Yeah. So it'll be a similar story with this, which is unfortunate because, you know, against some of the things that I'm sure it'll be nominated against, you know, it's probably more deserving, but that's the Oscars for you. Are you excited at all for The Fabelmans, knowing that, you know, it's getting this buzz behind it, or are you kind of like meh?
I'm kind of meh because it's Spielberg. I appreciate a lot of his films, but he's never been like a must-see director for me.
Right.
I mean, Saving Private Ryan's incredible. A lot of the other movies he's done has been incredible, but he doesn't really hold in my heart the same cultural sort of importance as a lot of other people, partly because, you know, I appreciate Jaws. I appreciate what E.T. was, but neither of those films are films that really, I would say, are my favorites. Not to mention that Spielberg is, to me, always related to Tom Hanks. And Tom Hanks, to me, is one of the most unwatchable actors these days.
Mm. I mean, he keeps making very bad choices. So,
have you seen the latest reviews for his Pinocchio film?
Oh, yeah.
It is really, really bad. And I thought, what was the last Tom Hanks movie I saw? Actually, I didn't see this, but Elvis...
Yeah.
I mean, that looked awful.
I've heard people saying that, like, if you can enjoy Elvis, if you go in and you only pay attention to the Austin Butler scenes and you just pretend that Tom Hanks isn't there.
So Austin Butler's actually watchable in that? No, that's a pretty
incredible. Because apparently it's kind of like a Rami Malek in Bohemian Rhapsody type performance where he just, like, he is the character and, like, he's doing such a good job. But, like, the problem is that...
It's Baz Luhrmann and Tom Hanks.
Yeah, so.
Well, that's really interesting because Austin Butler looks nothing like Elvis.
No, yeah, I agree, yeah.
Like, he does not give off the same vibe at all. In fact, he gives off a very different vibe, but...
Well, Banshees of Inisherin is coming to VIFF. Is there anything else at VIFF that you want to set up? Because we'll probably be talking about that in the next episode.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I'm slightly unprepared for that question.
Oops.
But there's that Koreeda film, Broker.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to that, yeah.
There's a Korean actress in there. Her name is IU, just like the letters IU, but it's a stage name. She is a very famous K-pop star in Korea.
Oh.
And she did this Netflix TV show called I think it's called My Mister in English, but she does an incredible job in it. She has like serious acting chops, so I'm looking forward to that one for sure. Some of the stuff you mentioned I'm gonna go see or try and go see, Inisherin, Triangle of Sadness. There's a couple other, you know, smaller projects that I'm interested to see. Some of them are from Hong Kong or Japan or Taiwan.
Mm.
These are some of the films that we would otherwise never get a chance to see unless we're in those areas or at the film festival.
But yeah, I think that about does it for this episode. Come on back next time. We'll probably be catching you up on not only VIFF, but also maybe a bit more of Rings of Power and House of the Dragon. Maybe even the messy tale of Don't Worry, Darling. because we haven't talked about
any
of that stuff.
Are we actually going down that path? Are we going down that celeb gossip path?
It's coming out in like a week, and I feel like, you know, we owe it to ourselves to see what all the fuss is about. So,
I mean, we both like Florence Pugh, so I think that's probably the connection there.
All right. Well, until then, my name is Robert Snow in Toronto.
And my name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.